Our reading today is really another story. It's from a book called Hope for the Flowers that actually my mom bought for me when I was a little girl. It's by an author named Trina Paulus, and it's about two caterpillars who live in some distant and wonderful place. One of them is named Yellow, and she is, surprise, a yellow caterpillar. And Yellow watches as all of the caterpillars in the whole area climb and climb and climb to this one place and keep climbing and climbing and climbing. And every time Yellow goes up to one of the caterpillars and asks, "What are you climbing to?" the caterpillars say, "We don't know, but everyone else is doing it." And eventually Yellow gets tired of climbing and asks what it is she really ought to be doing. Hope for the Flowers by Trina Paulus. Yellow was sad. She knew she didn't want to keep climbing and climbing forever without knowing where she was going. She knew that the right thing to do was wait, but she didn't know where her life was going. She felt like doing something, anything, rather than all this uncertain and boring waiting. "What in the world do I really want?" she sighed. "It seems like it's different every few minutes, but I know there must be more." Finally, she became numb and wandered away from everything familiar. And one day she found a gray-haired caterpillar hanging upside down on a branch. He surprised her because he seemed all caught up in some wad of yucky, hairy stuff. "You seem in trouble," he said. "Can I help?" "You seem in trouble," Yellow said. "Can I help?" "No, my dear," the old gray-haired caterpillar said. "I have to do this to become a butterfly." Her whole inside leapt up. "Butterfly," she thought. "Tell me, sir, what is a butterfly?" The old gray-haired caterpillar said, "It is what you are meant to become. It flies beautiful wings and joins the earth to heaven. It drinks nectar from the flowers, and it carries the seeds of love from flower to flower. Without butterflies, the world would have few flowers." "How does one become a butterfly?" she asked pensively. "You must want to fly so much that you are willing to give up being a caterpillar," said the old gray-haired caterpillar. "And if I decide to become a butterfly," Yellow said, "what do I do?" "Watch me," he said. "I'm making a cocoon. I know it looks like I'm hiding, but a cocoon is no escape. It's an in-between house where change takes place. It's a big step. You can never be a caterpillar again. During the change, it will seem to you or anyone else who might peek that nothing is happening. But a butterfly is already becoming. It just takes time." And Yellow decided to risk for becoming a butterfly. For courage, she hung herself right beside the other cocoon and began to spin her own. "Imagine," she thought, "I didn't even know I could do this. That's some encouragement. I'm on the right track. If I have the stuff inside of me to make cocoons, perhaps the stuff of butterflies is in there too." This sermon got started with me reading a quote that made me think, which happens a lot. This quote was by Thomas More, and he wrote that the great malady of the 20th century, the thing that is implicated in all of our troubles and that affects us both individually and socially, is the loss of soul. One of those comments that sort of resonated in my heart, that felt true even though I didn't really know what it meant. One of those that my heart cried out, "Yes, decry the loss of soul," and my brain chimed in with, "What precisely do you mean by soul, and what exactly would it mean to, say, lose it?" And if I would allow myself the ever-popular homiletic cliche of saying, Webster's New World Dictionary defines soul as such and such. I can certainly give you a very good, clear definition, but I don't really care about the dictionary answer. I want to know why the loss of soul felt so true to me. I want to know why the idea of having a soul, of living soulfully, matters in this world. I want to know what it means for me, and in so doing, hopefully, help you imagine what it might mean for you. I start with different images of the word soul, different ways people have thought about it over time. In ancient Egypt, the people believed that the soul, or ba, of the departed loved one lived on long after death. In ancient Egyptian graves, you can still find there honey, edible after thousands of years, that was stored in case the ba would wake up and be hungry. The people wanted to be prepared. That's how tangible the soul was, that ongoing, ever-living something. They stored away all those treasures on the off chance that the soul might just need them. And when the ancient Egyptians looked at their world, they imagined that nothing could be closer to the gods than a creature who could touch the heavens with its wingtips. And so they imagined the ba, the soul, in the form of a bird. The soul would soar up out of the body, apparently having eaten all of its fill of honey and drunk enough wine to feel strong, and fly up to heaven and there meet the gods in an eternal home. In much modern religious thought, the soul of the person is that part of them that lives on after death. It's the bodiless thing that is purely self, and that somehow advances to heaven or burns in hell, depending on one's actions in this lifetime. And in literature, the soul is often imagined as a person's most valuable possession. To lose it or to sell it is to bargain away one's reason for living, one's very essence, and in Christian theology, this is a particular theology that has made me mad for a long time, spearheaded by St. Augustine, the soul has been set up as the opposite of the body. The soul is God's territory. The things of the spirit are God's. The things of the body, the things of the earth, are not God's, are worldly, and are therefore bad. And so in many ways, throughout the Western traditions, we have divided the soul from the body into two distinct entities, one of which is pure and true and good, and one of which is evil, or at least decrepit in some way. We know that doctrine, let go of the body, cleave to the spirit. It's all too familiar, and it's never been too compelling for Unitarian Universalists. Of course, there are other definitions of soul. There's the definition of soul that you can only know through music. And perhaps it's the best definition of all. Soul music gets its name because the art form is so emotional you can feel it in your bones. It drips truth. And I can think of few higher compliments than to say of someone, he's got soul. It means, at least on some level, that he or she with soul can make you feel like crying or dancing with the notes of a song or the words of a poem. A soulful voice takes you right there with it, right into the emotion, right into the reason for the singing. To have soul is to live deeply. To see and feel and hear the emotion of one's life right at the surface, unvarnished, attuned, available for the taking, living soulfully is living so that you can feel life in your bones. Not just move through it, going along just fine, but feel it in your bones. In my own personal theology, I don't belabor the afterlife very much. My concern, and for the most part our concern as Unitarian Universalists, is with this life, now, the existing moments that have been given to us to make a difference for ourselves or others. Soul, then, for me and for us, is about this life, right now. And a soul in this life and not another is that life force within, the thing that sees beauty, the thing that melts when a baby looks into your eyes. It's the bit of self that doesn't toss and turn about getting a raise, but deeply cares whether or not the cherry blossoms will come out again this spring. It's the part of ourselves that doesn't strive, the thing that exists for something other than success. It's that mushy part inside that can't help but hurt sometimes, the elated part that always wants to cry at a good movie, that little bit of you that keeps you coming to church on days like today, hoping there is more to this whole mess of life than the effort to accomplish yet more. Losing soul, then, means losing sight of that which matters more than our own striving for perfection. Losing soul involves losing that core of genuine compassion and authentic care that can creep out of our lives and touch the world around us. Thus, to rephrase Moore's comment, the great malady of the 20th century, implicated in all of our troubles and affecting us individually and socially, is the loss of our ability to live for anything else besides striving and accomplishment. The loss of soul is the inability to live for anything besides success. And the inability to live soulfully in this world, the inability to feel life in our bones, could indeed be debilitating. The best quote about soul that I think I've ever heard is from the Prophet Muhammad, who said, "If I had only 2 loaves of bread, I would barter one for hyacinths to nourish my soul." The soul is the part of you that would do such a thing. The loss of it is the loss of color, of fragrance, of beauty, of art, the barter of magnificence for mere existence. To live soulfully is to barter bread for hyacinths, to trade subsistence for beauty, to look at the ordinary and see something magnificent. And this Sunday, in the Christian world, marks a particular day on the calendar when a few wise men looked at something ordinary and saw something magnificent. Today is the Feast of the Epiphany in the Christian calendar. In Greek, the word epiphany means to reveal or to show, and it commemorates the night that the wise men supposedly came to that much talked about stable in Bethlehem and revealed to the world that that infant Jesus was not just a baby, but a bringer of hope. In the Christian world, the epiphany is looked upon as the great reveal. It's the moment when it all became clear, when the inner soul of that little baby showed that it would not just be a caterpillar, but a butterfly. It's as if the wise men came, knelt down next to Mary, and said, "You thought this baby was just here to cry and eat and sleep, but really, it's hope incarnate." In the Christian tradition, those wise men or women looked into the soul of a child and saw there not just another cranky kid, but a reason to go on. They had what amounts to a big aha that awakened them to a truth they hadn't seen before. They had an epiphany. Finding soul in our lives, looking past the constant striving, requires epiphanies, all our own. Normandy Ellis says that we are aware of our own soulfulness when the epiphanies of life occur, the aha, when the light suddenly illuminates the darkness. We are aware of our own soulfulness when we remember why we do the things we do. We live soulfully when we see with a newfound light that we are more than commuters, more than numbers, more than useful workers on another useful day in America. We are aware of our own soulfulness when we see with a flash of light what the wise men saw in the baby Jesus. They looked and they didn't just see a baby, they saw hope. Might we look at ourselves and see there not just another person among all the people, but an instrument of peace, a butterfly, where once we thought there was only a caterpillar. Perhaps the loss of soul was the plague of the 21st century. Perhaps it continues into the 21st. People lose their souls all the time, forget how to live soulfully. And let me tell you, institutions and churches lose their souls far more easily than people do. I want to end this morning by telling yet one more story. It's a story about soul. It's a story about people who meant well, who worked hard and labored to do something good together. And it's a story to me about how high the stakes might be if good people lose the soul of their togetherness. There was once a group of people who built their rickety houses on the slopes overlooking a beach that bordered a treacherous, rock-bound coast. Now, year after year, these people would look out their living room windows, they would sit by their warm fireplaces, and they would watch the reefs and the rocks that surrounded them with agony as ship after ship became foundered and stranded on that tumultuous sea. For years, this went on. Until finally the people got tired of watching and waiting. They knew that all they had to do to make a difference was act, and they decided to band together and do something. They decided what they would do is to form a rescue society, a society with the sole purpose of saving those who were shipwrecked upon that coast. They would learn and they would perfect their craft. They would go and do everything to the best of their ability, and together they would risk their lives for the purpose of saving others. And for years this went on. They risked life and limb. They ran out in the freezing waters when no one else dared. They scoured the coast for people in need, and hundreds who would otherwise have died were brought to safety. Generation after generation of these rescuers joined the society. And as they looked out around them at the world, they noticed that everybody else's rescue societies seemed to be having technological advancements they didn't. Of course, they wanted to do everything perfectly and everything with the best technique possible, so they began to attend rescue workshops. They began to bring in advisors and experts on the latest rescue techniques. They began to throw parties for the people who sold the latest rescue equipment. And soon enough, the perfection and maintenance of the rescue station, the newest ways to rescue, and the best equipment for the job became the new focus of the rescue society. And what happened? I bet you can guess. One night, as they all sat around in yet another conference to talk about how to get the best advancements in technology and the best technique for rescuing an ocean liner, a great boat struck the reef and sank. Hundreds of people were lost because there was no one to go to the rescue because everybody was so busy learning how to rescue better. The society had come to exist for its own perfection and not for the sake of others. The rescue society had come to exist for its own perfection. It lost its soul, its pervading and life-giving reason to exist, and in falling from its grand and worthy aims, the society became not a soulful but an ambitious institution. Its goals replaced its heart. Its tasks replaced its reason for existing. The rescue society lost its soul, and no amount of ambition, no amount of success or strategizing or analysis can replace a soul. That story from a book by Robert M. Mulholland reminded me of Brew, not in that we, like the rescue society, have lost our soul, far from it. It made me think of our congregation, because our soul, that life-affirming and even sometimes life-saving something that draws us here, is as vital to our community as the rescue society was to that rock-bound coast. We exist to be a haven, a safe place for people who are safe nowhere else, a community for those who seek deeper connection than they can find outside our doors. We are drawn together by the living, pulsing soul of this institution to be here for one another and for all those yet to find us, to be here and to reach out with our saving message that God will not smite you and we will not judge you, and there is such a thing as religion without dogma. Like the rescue society, we exist because we are needed. Because there are shipwrecks only we can salvage, and because there are hurts only we can heal, our soul, that driving force, that utter necessity of our presence in our community, lies underneath all the words in our mission statement, our board agendas, and our eventual long-range plan. It lies underneath and between everything we do in every committee and every religious education class and every small group meeting. It lies underneath and between every holiday party and every conversation you have in the parking lot. And that soul, the core of who we are, cannot be replaced by any form of ambition. Not for growth, not for glory, not for grandiosity, not even for the desire to succeed at all of our appointed tasks. That soul, that living, beating thing that brings us together, is the tie that binds. And all the success that we may have, all the success we do have, arises from the steady and persistent beating living soul of our community. The rescue society, not unlike so many individual lives and communities, failed when it lost its soul. It failed when it lost its sense of meaning and purpose beyond the everyday affairs of striving to succeed. In our lives and in our church, for all of our planning and all of our committee meetings, for all of our earnest desires to do and be better in every way, we must never forget that the soul underlies it all, the heart of it, the very humanity of the thing we do here, does not depend on how successful we are or how much we do. It depends on how good we are to one another. Individually and collectively, we will strive, but we will not lose our souls in the process. To live soulfully is to live with one eye on the sunrise and one eye on the traffic every day during your commute. It is to barter bread for hyacinths, to remember that underneath all the work and all the worry and every bit of planning that fills our lives, there is a guiding living soul of purpose that guides all that we do. Let us go forward this morning not bent on success, not intent upon proving ourselves to the world, but ready to see beauty, to embrace life, to feel it in our bones, so that someone somewhere might look at us, at our congregation, and at every one of us and say, "Those people have soul." May it be so.